and engaging in this practice that has been so meaningful for me, and I feel so fortunate to be able to share it with you, and then for you to take it to heart and practice with it is a wonderful thing to see, and I thank you for that. I want to read to you a poem that is a significant poem in the Theravada Buddhism, because it's the opening poem. It's a poem that opens a very big manual on meditation. It was written about 1,000 years after the Buddha, and is kind of like the definitive manual for Theravada meditation ever since then, for much of Theravada Buddhism. And the poem goes. The poem comes from the early suttas, from the discourses of the Buddha, it goes like this: a tangle inside, a tangle outside. This generation is entangled in a tangle. I ask you this, O Gotama, O Buddha, who can disentangle this tangle? So someone's asking the Buddha this question. Who can disentangle this tangle? And it seems that in some ways, we could probably ask the same question for our generation. The world is tangled in a tangle. A tangle inside, meaning within ourselves, and a tangle outside of ourselves, meaning in our world that we live in. And who can untangle the tangle? So the answer the Buddha gives, a person who's established on virtue, who is wise and developed in developing the mind and developing wisdom. Someone who is motivated, ardent, and discreet. That is who can disentangle the tangle. So a few things. One is the importance of developing virtue, that it's very hard to develop the upper reaches of what mindfulness can do for us without also living a life of virtue, of a life which no way intentionally or knowingly is involved in harming other people through our body, speech, and even through our minds. And the connection between the two of them is that as we become more and more mindful, to do something unethical that's intentional and knowingly harming someone is really a closing down of that opening of the heart, that opening of the mind, that greater and greater clarity. If we're beginning to disentangle all the different attachments that we have, to be involved in causing harm is to go back into the world of entanglement. It goes against the grain. It goes against the very thing we're trying to develop. And then the person who can disentangle and tangle is also developing their mind and their wisdom, their ability to see clearly. And so we have in this tradition a tremendous importance on the regularity of practice. Day in, day out, we are constantly cultivating and developing our mind so it becomes clearer, more stable, more compassionate, more kind, more insightful. And now it might seem like a burden that, you know, day in, day out, that we're supposed to practice. But the fact is, day in and day out, we're always practicing something. Oftentimes not so consciously or intentionally. And if we don't choose what we practice, then it's chosen for us. It's chosen by our attachments, by our hates or our greeds or our desires or, what our preoccupations are about. And that those are practices too, in the sense that the more you repeat certain tendencies of the mind, the more they become habits, the more they become stronger and stronger. And so if you spend your time ruminating about something that's debilitating, you're actually practicing debilitating rumination if you keep doing it over and over again. If you spend a lot of time complaining, you're practicing complaining. If you spend a lot of time wanting things, going on the shopping channel and just, I want that, I want that, I want that, then you're practicing wanting, and wanting will get stronger. Whatever your mind is doing regularly becomes what the mind gets kind of groove of or develops and gets stronger. And so when we sit down to meditate, maybe for the first time, we discover what we've been practicing. If we've been practicing distractions, being lost in fantasy, being constantly involved in planning or whatever we might be doing, we see the strength of that when we sit down to meditate. Because we've been practicing, we've been cultivating, it's been stronger and stronger over time. So when we sit down to do mindfulness, there's two powerful things that are happening. One is that we are interrupting the continuity of those old practices. We're interrupting the continuity of developing things which are not useful for us to develop. The other is we're developing things that are useful. We're developing the mind's capacity for mindfulness. We're developing the mind's capacity to let go. We're developing the mind's capacity to be kind, to be understanding, to be patient, to have some equanimity or spaciousness around things. So a whole bunch of things that come in the wake of practicing mindfulness. And that's why if you day in, day out, we're practicing mindfulness in some way or other, whether it's in our daily life or whether it's sitting in meditation, then we are involved in choosing. We have some role of choice involved in the direction in which we're developing ourselves. And if you don't choose that, if you just go along with business as usual, then, as I said earlier, your own attachments, your own kind of sometimes not so useful tendencies are going to be what you develop. Or there are people in the world who are paid lots of money to have you cultivate yourself in certain ways. There's advertisers who want you to be consumers. And they're clever. There are politicians who want you to be afraid and angry. And they're clever in how to reinforce that and get people to kind of repeat it themselves and talk to their friends in the same kind of way. And things, you know. And there are people who are trying to, there's a whole industry of people who are trying to influence the direction your mind grows and develops. But when you choose to be mindful, you're stepping out of all those influences, both the inner influences and the outer influences, and kind of little bit beginning to take, might not feel like this initially, but taking a little bit of charge of your inner life, yourself, and your mind. And the mind is malleable, mind is adaptable, changeable. And Buddhist practice is not only about having insight, not only about being maybe calm or having meditative experiences or something like that, but it's also about strengthening, developing the mind in certain directions. So this idea that we are developing the mind, developing ourselves through practice of mindfulness, and that it points to the idea that another idea that you find in Buddhism, it's a little bit my paraphrase of it, but and that is that at any given moment that we find ourselves in, there's always a fork in the road. You can go one way or the other. And from the Buddha's point of view, you can either choose the direction which is healthy or unhealthy. You can choose a direction which is what he calls wholesome or unwholesome, helpful or unhelpful, that there is a kind of distinction made. So if you, you know, if you have been watching TV a lot and feel kind of spent and lazy and kind of dull and numb from all the TV, or, and so you like, it's too uncomfortable, this mind of mine, this body of mine. So I think I'll just distract myself by watching more TV. So then you've taken the unhelpful direction. But if you, that moment, you say, wait a minute, the impact of all this TV viewing that I'm doing, not so good. But if I go for a walk around the block, that's something healthy and that I can do. And all these small moments in the as the day goes along, whether you know it or not, whether you choose to act on it or not, there is a kind of choice. When I came back from the Zen monastery, I was there for 3 years practicing. And in the monastery, there's a lot of choreographed behavior, meaning that when you step into the meditation hall, you step into the hall through with a particular foot. You bow many times coming to your meditation seat. You stand a certain way. You hold your hands a certain way. You eat in the meditation hall. You eat in a very particular way. It's all these things, kind of like everyone's doing the same moves. So it's kind of like a dance. It's wonderful theater, kind of. And but when I left the monastery, I wasn't required to do all these choreographed moves anymore. But what had happened in the 3 years, in the doing all that for all these years, a kind of a mindfulness practice, I discovered that I actually had a lot of choice, much more than I ever realized before, about how I conducted myself. So for example, how I sat in a chair, when I was younger, I just sat in a chair, didn't think about it. But after the 3 years in the monastery, I saw I had a choice about how I sat down in a chair. Do I sit straight? Do I slump? You know, do I use a backrest or not use the backrest? And there's, you know, myriad of choice on such a simple thing as sitting in a chair. And it was actually empowering for me to see I had these choices, because I could choose the choice that was most helpful, most appropriate for the circumstance, the one that was most skillful, the one that maybe supported my mindfulness and my presence. And so I remember I was so amazed by all this, and I used exactly what I told you as an example of what I discovered in my one-on-one practice discussion with the abbot. And, you know, it's a kind of formal, we're sitting cross-legged in meditation posture facing each other. It's kind of a very formal thing in Zen, and in a small room with Buddha statue nearby. And it's kind of a ritual to go for practice discussion. You don't just push the Zoom button and you're in the room. So I told him this thing about the chair, and I saw I had all these choices. And he did something which was a little bit out of characteristic for this Japanese cultural Zen training model that we were enacting. He reached out his hand and shook my hand. He was so pleased, like, congratulations, you, that, you know, to realize this, that, you know, that you have this choice all the time. And it doesn't have to be a burden or make you feel busy to feel like you have that choice, because one of the simplest choices you have is to do nothing. And sometimes doing nothing, not going down the wrong path, is much better than going doing something which is unhealthy. And to learn how to not give in to those and just hold your ground, take your stand, just be there, can be relaxing. It can be like, okay, I don't have to do that. I don't have to turn on the TV. I don't have to go to the refrigerator. I don't have to complain for a tenth time to my friend about something. I can just be quiet. Doing nothing actually is very powerful. Of course, we don't want to do nothing all the time, and this practice of ours is not meant to be passive. So luckily, doing nothing for a practitioner is not really doing nothing, because it's an opportunity to be mindful, to pause. Okay, what is going on here? Let me take a second look, that respect thing that I talked about. Let me respect this. Let me look at this again. What's happening here? Let me wake up. What is happening in this situation? And I can't tell you how many times that I've done that, done this very thing where I didn't say anything or do something, but instead just kind of looked around and said, what's happening here? What's happening within me? What's happening outside of me? And I'm so glad I took the time to find out, because what I was going to blurt out, what I was going to do was not really appropriate for the situation. But when I took my time to really tune in, what's happening here? That then I could be more, a little bit wiser about what I did. And, but it's not only about becoming mindful. So this mindfulness practice that's so popular these days, from a Buddhist point of view, is shortchanging the full potential of what this Buddhist practice can be about. Mindfulness is only one piece of Buddhist training. And certainly it's helpful to develop mindfulness, and a lot of other things come and follow in the wake of mindfulness. But Buddhist practice is also involves training ourselves, cultivating, developing other useful states of mind in addition to mindfulness. Certainly for meditators, it's useful to develop concentration. It's useful to develop compassion, loving kindness. It's useful to develop patience, generosity. It's useful to develop equanimity. It's useful to develop right speech. It goes on, all these things we can develop. And again, you don't have to do them all at once. But the principle here is that we're trying, when we come to the fork in the road, we're trying to do the things that will help us to grow in a way that would help us to thrive. And that's my translation of a Buddhist word, that the Buddha talks about people growing and thriving and expanding with practice. And this idea of thriving, sometimes when people hear about do nothing or just be mindful, it feels a little bit dull. I don't know how it is for you, but sometimes it seems a little bit dull, just be mindful. But it's really only a piece of a very helpful piece, and a bigger piece to really help our hearts, our minds, our whole being to thrive and become happy and become engaged in something that's meaningful. And to develop some of the most beautiful qualities we have in our within. The Buddha talked about cultivating beauty, that we, through meditation and through Buddhist practice, we're cultivating a beautiful mind, a beautiful inner life. So this is a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing to have an inner beauty that we're growing and developing in. The Buddha talks about developing inner wealth. He talked about loving kindness and compassion being wealth. And that's quite an interesting statement to refer those to wealth as opposed to a bank account being wealth. And which is portable? Which is the best investment? Cultivating greater compassion or a bigger bank account? So if from the Buddhist point of view, it's all these things we're developing and cultivating. And I like to think of it, it's a lifetime project. It's one of the great things to do in a life. And for me, it's nice to know that there's a direction of greater growth and development and greater freedom that's possible. And we're moving in the direction of more freedom and developing. But it's so good to be on the path. It's so wonderful and so meaningful. Each day, each minute, each moment of practicing, that it's fulfilling in itself regardless how far we get on the path. To be too concerned about getting to the end of the path, let me be the first person in my block who gets enlightened, and I'll show everybody else, you know, who's who around here. That's not really freedom. But just to the certain humility, the certain kind of dedication and love of just kind of practicing for its sake, because it's so good to be on the path. It's a good path. It's going in a good direction, and it's very, very satisfying. So whether we get to the end of the path before we die is not that important for the people who are thriving, enjoying, and finding their way on the path as far as they go for this life. It's fantastic to walk the path. And the rewards come back in all kinds of ways. And they're surprising what comes back to you as you practice and develop here along this way. So this is all kind of an encouragement day in and day out. Do something that's called practice. Do something that you either meditate every day or practice mindfulness in daily life, practice kindness in everyday life. Practice the things which are wholesome and beneficial. And if you try to do all of it quickly, that's not wholesome. That's not helpful. That's not the path. To do too much dharma is poor dharma. So you want to do it slow enough that you have time to integrate it and digest it and really be affected in a good way by what you're doing. To rush through the practice and go to every possible retreat, read every possible Dharma book, and just do every possible practice all in one day, probably is counterproductive. But a contemplative life, which I love that phrase for myself, to take a life that has time in it and space in it, and to really be able to let things register and feel what's happening, and let this choices we make, the choices we make at that junction of the fork that we come to every moment, the choices we make, if we, you know, are impactful, and the good choices have a greater impact. If we go slow enough, we can let it register. So if you practice mindfulness in the morning, like practice mindfulness meditation in the morning, or any kind of meditation in the morning, before your rest of your day starts, if your meditation ends, maybe you have a little bell that goes off, and it's kind of like the horse is out of the gate at the race is when you hear that bell. Where you pop up, you rush over to get your coffee, you rush over to turn on your computer to read the news, you're brushing your teeth at the same time as having your breakfast, and you're getting out the door as fast as you can. And by the time you get to work or get to school or wherever you're going, whatever benefit you got from meditation has been lost. And I hope no one's that bad, but that was just for the purposes of emphasis. I described it that way. But instead, to come out of meditation and not be in a hurry to go to the next thing. Go to the next thing, but do it in what leisurely time. So that some of the benefit of the meditation can continue to influence and impact you, condition you, cultivate you, develop you. Live a life that there's space, there's time to be impacted by the Dharma, the practice that you're engaged in. I think there's a kind of a illness in this culture sometimes of wanting it all, wanting everything. And I think that Dharma practice goes in the opposite direction. Or maybe it goes in that direction, but in a different way. You get everything when you have nothing. When you want nothing, then everything is yours in a certain way. So so I have offered you some basic instructions for mindfulness of breathing and body and emotions and thinking, and to continue practicing these things is the way to disentangle the tangle. Rather than all of those things kind of collapsing in a big tangle and we can't really see what's happening under the hood of our lives and why we're suffering or why we're struggling, being able to disentangle these different strands of our life, the strands of our breathing, the strands of our physical body, the strands of our thinking and emotions, we begin to see more clearly what's there. And the more clear we see, the more we see that we stand in a moment of choice. And the more choices you see, the more choices you have. The people who don't see any choice have no choice. But the more choice you see, the more there's the possibility of freedom. And this mindfulness practice brings us into the territory of freedom over and over and over again. Whenever it shows us, oh, here I have a choice. Am I free to choose that which is healthy and beneficial and continues my freedom? Or am I being compelled down some other road that is the opposite of freedom? So disentangling the tangle. And I hope that after these days of being in retreat, and we end the retreat in a short while, that you hopefully you don't have to be like the horse at the races and just take off and get yourself really busy, but rather to take your time in the contemplative, at least for the rest of the day, and let the impact of doing this retreat kind of have a chance to be digested and absorbed and help you grow and thrive in this Dharma life. So thank you so much for this.